If you'd like to turn to John chapter 10, we're going to be continuing our study of the Gospel of John tonight. We'll actually begin down in verse 22. I have been looking for a while for some good illustrations of the temple area for us to look at so that we can have an idea in our mind of what was going on in these passages where it talks about Jesus walking in the temple, and in one place it talks about him being in the treasury. Another place it talks about him entering the gate. I know Peter and John healed a blind man, a lame man that had been sitting at the beautiful gate at one point in Acts. And so there are a lot of things described about the temple, but sometimes we don't really have much of a picture of what it was really like. And of course, it's difficult for us to know what it was really like because it's not there anymore. And so it's difficult for us to even imagine sometimes this structure that was so impressive that when Jesus described its destructions, the apostles thought, surely he's talking about the end of the world, because nothing could destroy this incredible monument that's been built. And here we have one of those pictures that describes it a little bit. And as you look here, this is the entire temple complex. This is the foundational wall. And one of these outer walls, where the foundation is all that's left now, is those foundational walls. Any of these buildings that you see built up here on top, these have all been destroyed. They were all torn down by the Romans about 35 to 40 years after Jesus spoke of these things in 70 A.D., So, all of this, and of course, this is just an artist's rendition. This is actually, it says at the top, Robertson's theory based on what he read in Josephus. So, Josephus described what the temple was like. Josephus had apparently actually seen it. And how he knew by memory all the measurements and things like that, I don't know. I mean, imagine, if you will, if this building was destroyed. How many of us could say, well, it was such and such many feet long and so many feet wide, and well, most of us don't know. We wouldn't know how big it was, we kind of remember what it looked like, but we wouldn't be able to tell somebody the size. Well, Josephus wrote about the temple and described it in as great a detail as he could remember and gave some dimensions and things. But as you see here, down at the bottom here, I'm kind of blocking that, but there's a big walkway that goes across this huge valley. That's the Kidron Valley. You may remember the Kidron Valley because that is the place that David fled when Absalom took over the throne. He ran across the Kidron Valley. There was a river that ran through there. He ran across, got across there and got out of the city and escaped. You may also remember Jesus going to the Mount of Olives. Most people, the Mount of Olives would be over here on this side of this big walkway and big bridge. And so all around it, they're basically, it was up on the mountain, so all around it is this valley. That's why it was called the Temple Mount. And now, the other thing you'll see here, maybe if you can read that, it says Dome of the Rock. That's what's there now. And we'll show you a picture of that in a minute as we talk about it. But as we look at John chapter 10 and verse 22... remember, they had just been arguing again about who Jesus was. In verse 21, they said, "Hey, these are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" They're still debating, because some say he's got a demon, and others say, wait a minute, a demon can't heal a blind man. And they're still talking about what had happened in chapter 9. And I promise you, after that big lunch that we just had, I'm not going to ask anybody to close their eyes today. Okay, we can do that in the morning before we've eaten lunch. We don't want to try that this afternoon. We'd just all take a good long nap if we did that. I might fall asleep even up here if we did that. So we won't do that today. But in verse 22 then, it says, "At that time, the feast of dedication took place at Jerusalem. And it was winter." Now I'm going to ask you to think about this question. Have you ever read in the Old Testament anywhere about a feast of dedication? What was this feast of dedication that it's talking about? There are a lot of feasts spoken of in the Old Testament. there are some really big feasts, like the Passover. That was a big one when they came out of Egypt. We remember that one. There was a Feast of Unleavened Bread that followed that for several days. There was a Feast of the First Fruits, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast, there were all these feasts that they had. The Feast of Ingathering at the end of the harvest. They had all these feasts. And then in the book of Esther, we read about a new feast that they started, a new celebration called Purim. After she saved her people from annihilation, they celebrated that by having a big party and giving each other gifts and having a good time. But you never anywhere in the Bible, in the Old Testament, read about this Feast of Dedication. But notice what it says about it. It was the time of the Feast of the Dedication took place in Jerusalem, and it was winter. Can anybody think of a Jewish holiday that takes place in winter? Maybe kind of close to one of our holidays that we have around, you know, near Christmas time. Can you think of a Jewish holiday? We've probably all heard of Hanukkah. Well, Hanukkah is the Jewish holiday that is this Feast of Dedication. It wasn't in the Old Testament because it hadn't happened yet. Hanukkah, or the Feast of Dedication, was one of those celebrations that actually started during the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so you have a new feast, a new celebration. And this particular one was because there was a really nasty guy who came, and he came into Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes is his name. And he came in there, and he made the Jews... Do you remember one of the animals that the Jews thought was unclean, that we really like a lot, and we eat it all the time? It's pork, pigs, bacon and sausage and all those things. Hope some of you celebrated Groundhog Day this past week with some good sausage. But we eat pork all the time, but they can't eat pork. It's unclean to them. And there is nothing that they could imagine that would be any worse than to take an unclean animal like a pig and sacrifice it to God. That's an abomination to them. That's just disgusting above all that we can imagine. And that's what this guy did. He came in there with his army, and he came into Jerusalem, and he came to their temple, and he just destroyed things along the way and killed people along the way. And then when he got there, he took some pigs and he made the priests sacrifice those pigs on God's altar. Well, there was a family. Maybe you've heard of this family called the Maccabees. Well, the Maccabees was a family that didn't want to have anything to do with this guy and was ready to fight about it. And so they got up an army and they fought him. And they won. And they kicked him back out of Israel, out of Jerusalem, out of Judea. And after they got him kicked out of there, they went back to the temple. And do you remember when they first built the temple and Moses, there was all these things about you sprinkle the blood on this and you sprinkle the blood on that and you purify this and you purify that? Well, they went through that whole regimen again and purified and cleansed the temple of that pork blood and that had been spilled there and of that pork that had been burned on that altar. And they cleaned it all out and they purified it. And when they did that, when they got finished doing that, they had a celebration about it. And they rededicated the temple, just like Solomon had dedicated it back in his day when he finished building it. They dedicated their temple again to God. And so this is the time of year it is. And Hanukkah is going to fall, you know, the first part to the middle of December. It kind of fluctuates. Remember, we've talked before, the Jewish calendar is kind of weird because they go on the cycles of the moon. So sometimes they have 12 months and sometimes they have 13. And that'd be a little confusing, I think, to me. I have enough trouble remembering which month it is without them sticking an extra one in there every once in a while. Leap year with an extra day in February is tough enough. Can you imagine a whole extra month? But they did that to keep the cycle in the right way, to keep spring coming at the right time, and those kinds of things. But then it says on top of that in verse 23, Jesus was walking in the temple, in the colonnade of Solomon, or Solomon's porch, some call it. And so, as we think about this temple, and we see this big, huge place, and it's hard to tell even from this picture. We've got one here in a minute. We'll show you the scale of it. But as we look at this temple a little closer, we notice some of the things that were going on here. You have up here in this corner the Antonia Fortress. There was a whole garrison of Roman soldiers that were stationed right there in that fortress, right at the corner of the temple. Right there. You ever wonder how when Paul was having trouble, remember he went to the temple and they accused him of bringing Gentiles into the temple where they didn't belong, and they grabbed him and they started beating him, and boom, just in a matter of moments, there was Roman soldiers there getting him before they could kill him. Because, you know, they wouldn't have wasted any time killing him. Where do you think those Roman soldiers came from? Well, they came from right there. There were stairs right down there, from there down into this court area. The courtyard. Now this section here and around the front here and around on this side is the court of the Gentiles. If you were not a Jew, you could go into that area. It'd be kind of like being able to come into the foyer, come into the entryway, the lobby area of the, but you couldn't come inside. And that was as far as any Gentile could go. And there were some historians even talk about there being signs posted. And they'd have a little, you know, like a little railing or something, a little something to mark it off. That if you're a Gentile, if you go past here, you die. Don't go past there, or you forfeit your life if you walk past there. You know, we've seen those, warning. This home is protected by Smith and Wesson or something like that. Well, in this case, they didn't have Smith and Wesson. What they had was that big pile of rocks. Remember, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. That when Jesus did these things and performed these miracles and did things they didn't like, they'd grab the stones and they were ready to stone him to death. And he'd disappear. Well, this is why he could disappear. Look how big an area this is. He could leave out of this part. This is the part where the Israelites could come to. So he could be in here with them and he could just slip out this gate and mix in here with all the Gentiles and disappear into the crowd. And there were as many as 12 different entrances. They're showed one here and one here, but there was as many as 12 entrances around this thing that you could go in or out of. So he could quickly disappear and go away from them. But now we want to notice one more thing. This again shows the temple, the courtyard here, and this is the actual temple right here. This is the holy place and the Holy of Holies in there. And only the priest could go in there. The altar for burnt offerings would have been right up in here in front of the temple. And that's where the Jews could come. And if they had a sacrifice, when you had a sacrifice, if you brought a sacrifice, you brought the sacrifice to the priest, you laid your hands on that sacrifice, transferring the guilt, if it was a sin offering, or whatever trespass offering, you were transferring your sin to that animal that was about to be killed. And then the priest would take it and kill it and put it on the altar. This is something that it's hard for me to imagine it, and maybe it is for you too. Maybe you've got a good grasp on it. But can you imagine mixing church worship of God with an animal slaughterhouse? That just seemed like a really odd combination, but that's pretty much what the temple was. They come in, they're having worship, they're having these prayers, they're singing the psalms, and in the middle of some of the psalms, some of the way they do some of the during the psalms, they slit the throats of the animals and blood's everywhere, and then they're skinning the animals and putting them on the altar. It's hard for me to imagine that. You know, we think about, you know, we want our church building to be clean and we want it to look nice, well, and we want it to smell nice. And that just doesn't mix well with killing a bunch of animals and burning them, does it? Although a barbecue does smell pretty good. But you think about the things that they were doing, and the blood all over, blood upon blood. Thousands upon thousands of animals, especially at a big feast like, especially at Passover. At the time of the Passover feast, when there had to be one lamb offered for every group of anywhere from 10 to 20 people to eat that lamb. Can you imagine an entire nation, how many lambs they would have to slaughter? The estimates are anywhere from 200 to 300,000 lambs were slaughtered on that one day in the temple. Can you imagine how long that would take? Well, certainly if there's only one guy doing it. The good news was there were 24 different groups of priests that all did it. But these are the kinds of things that Jesus saw day in and day out in the temple. He would see these things. If you went into the temple on any given day, at morning they had a sacrifice. Afternoon time, they had a sacrifice. Every day. And then those special days like Passover, they had thousands of sacrifices. And in addition to the morning, it's kind of like, you know, we have Sunday morning and Sunday evening. Well, all in between there, anyone who had a sin offering that they needed to bring, or if they wanted to bring a fellowship offering, or if they wanted to bring a guilt offering, or if they wanted to be cleansed of some impurity, like Jesus telling the lepers, you know, go to the temple and be cleansed. Anything like that they wanted to do, they had to bring that animal, whether it was doves or whether it was pigeons or whether it was lambs or whether it was goats or bulls, whatever they had to bring, they brought it to the temple, and the priests that were on duty, and there would be dozens of priests on duty every day, and their job was when people brought the sacrifices, they took care of the sacrificing of those sacrifices. And you can just imagine, one after another, killing it, sprinkling the blood there, throw it on the altar. Next guy gets his, kill it, put it on the altar. And you can imagine some days it would have been like that all day long. They would have been all day making these sacrifices. And there was a rule that no one could sit down in the temple. Well, they didn't have time to sit down anyway. That's why it's significant when it talks in Hebrews about Jesus going to his Father's right hand and sitting down. Because as long as the priest was doing his work, as long as he was making the sacrifice, he couldn't sit down. When his job was done, then he could go, well, let's go back to that for just a minute. He could go back to one of these little rooms right here. These were the rooms that were kind of outside the edge of the temple. He'd go back to one of those rooms and then he could sit down. And he could rest a little. But not until his job was done. And then, of course, after his... And interestingly enough, the priests only worked like 1 or 2 weeks out of the year of their term. They'd take the... it's kind of like National Guard, you know, 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year. So it's kind of like that. But they had 24 different groups. So one group would come in for a week, next group would come in for a week, next group would come in for a week. But at a time like Passover, they all had to come. So they would get maybe their 2 regular weeks and then they all had to be there at a feast like Passover. But as we look at this, I want you to notice this section right down here. And it's kind of hard to see, but you can see it better on this side. You see all the little posts and there's a roof covering this section. Well, this side's the same way. This is called Solomon's portico or Solomon's porch. That's the area of the temple that Jesus was walking. Now, what I want us to notice, though, about this is, I want us to notice, you know, we think, oh, well, you know, he's walking down this little walkway. I want you to notice this over here. Here is the outside edge of the temple that we looked at here. And this over here is the royal portico. Well, here's the royal portico right here. But look at this little black rectangle over here. You know what that is? That's the size of a football field. So when Jesus was walking along this little walkway, it was really as wide as a football field and about 2.5 to 3 times as long as a football field. See, he wasn't just walking down a little aisle like this. It was massive. Remember we talked about there could be hundreds of thousands of people in this whole temple complex area at one time. And there would constantly be rabbis having their little classes, teaching people, talking to people, you know, telling them, scribes there, telling their views on God. All these things would be going on in this temple area. As well as the fact that the Sanhedrin Council also met in this temple area. They met a little closer. Now this right here, the actual front entrance to the temple, this is the front entrance to the temple complex, but this is the front entrance to the actual temple itself. That's the beautiful gate. That's where that guy over there in Acts that Peter and John healed that was lame, that's where he was sitting. He was sitting right at the front of the temple. And everybody that went in would see him. And he was begging for money, of course, when they saw him. So this is where Jesus is. He's walking in this area. He's in this huge, massive place. Bigger by far than our football stadium that we have today. This, however, is what it looks like today. Now this is turned a little bit. This side would have been the side that was over here in the other pictures. And this would have been the wall that we were seeing right across here in the other pictures. But that's the Dome of the Rock. That's the mosque. The Muslim mosque that's built there today. And of course, you see there you see some buildings built up here on this part. None of those are any of the buildings that had anything to do with the Jewish temple. Those are all buildings the Muslims built when they took over the area. And so you've got the mosque there where the Muslims have control and all of the rest of it. But you see, as Jesus is walking along in that area, there on that covered porch. So that way, even if it was raining or something, they could still be in there. And it was open air, but at least it was covered. But he's walking along that area. And the Jews say to him in verse 24, "How long are you going to keep us in suspense? If you're the Christ, just tell us plainly. Tell us if you're really Him. If you're the Messiah, just say so." Now, why do you suppose they wanted him to just say so? Was it so, if he said, "Yes, I am the Messiah," would they have believed in him? No. They wanted him to say it so that they would have something concrete to accuse him of. Because they couldn't find any real concrete thing to say. Well, this is the thing he said that was just wrong and sinful, and we should be able to kill him for it. And that's what they were looking for. But it's interesting, verse 25, Jesus says, "I told you and you don't believe. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me, but you don't believe because you are not my sheep." We talked about that a little bit last week in the first part of chapter 10, where he talks about himself being the good shepherd and the shepherd of the sheep and the sheep hearing his voice. You see, it doesn't matter what he says to these people. They're not going to listen to him because they're not his sheep. They're just not going to hear anything he says. Kind of like a parent with a teenager. But he says, "You know, you just don't listen. I've told you before. Same thing I said to you before. Just like that. But you're not my sheep." He says, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." And then in verse 28, this is some wonderful news. Because, you know, with all the sacrifices, with all the death, you realize that the Jewish religion was all about death. Morning and night, an animal had to die, and every time they sinned, an animal had to die to remind them that they were the ones that deserved the death. Now maybe that would be a good thing for some to be reminded when they do what's wrong. You know what? You deserve to die for that, and you're going to have to let this animal die in your place. But fortunately for us, God had a better plan. He said, "I'm going to send my Son, and He's going to die one time." And that's why when we partake of the Lord's Supper every Sunday, on every first day of the week, we remind ourselves that we were supposed to die, but He died for us. And notice verse 28, "I give them eternal life, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and the Father are one. You see, in the Jewish religion, the law said, these are my commandments. If you do them, you shall live in them. In other words, as long as you live by them, as long as you keep making the sacrifice, then you'll live. But if you quit, then you deserve to die, and you'll die. But Jesus came along and said, I'm going to give my sheep eternal life. Not just a temporary reprieve. I'm going to give them eternal life. They can be forgiven. That sin will be gone forever. And he says, no one can snatch them out of my hand, and no one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. Now we talked about this with some folks on several occasions. People like to use this passage to say, well, see right there, it says, once you're saved, you're always saved. No, what it says is, nobody else can cause you to be lost. No one can snatch you away from God. Nobody is strong enough to take you away from God. But you can leave if you want to. You can walk right out. See, this verse doesn't say anything else, anything at all about walking out of His hand. It just says nobody can force you out. Nobody can snatch you out. Nobody can kidnap you or kidnap your soul. And that's good news. You know, in Jesus' day, you know, there was demon possession and all those things. Jesus says, no. We don't even have to worry about that anymore. No one can snatch us out. There's no demon. Satan can't do it. There's no way anyone else can force us out of God's control and out from under His hand and His blessings. There's nobody that can do that. What a shame then that there are so many people who refuse to have such a comfort. They fight against God and don't want to be in His hand. I mean, maybe they find it too restricting. I don't know. Christians don't get to have any fun or whatever they say. But the comfort and the joy of salvation that's in Christ Jesus and that we can have when we know we're in the Father's hand, and that nobody or no thing can overpower Him. There's nothing that can overpower Him. And of course, then He says, I and my Father are one. And what? How do you suppose they respond? Well, remember, they're in this temple. Remember, they didn't have the Smith & Wesson sign on the front door, but what they did have is they had some piles of rocks. And as soon as He said, my Father and I are one, verse 31, the Jews picked up stones again. I love the way the ESV puts that. They picked up stones again to stone Him. It wasn't the first time. They've done this before. This is their reaction to Him. We're going to stone you to death. What is our reaction to Christ? You know, sometimes Christ says some things that we may not be particularly fond of. We may not like some of the commands that He gives us. We might not like some of the teaching that He does. We may think, well, I'd rather do it this other way, or I'd rather not have to do this thing that You're telling me to do. How are we going to react to those things that He tells us to do? If we believe that He and His Father are one, if we believe that He is the Christ, the Messiah, if we are His sheep, then when He says something, even if it's something that we don't like, we're going to follow Him because He's the Good Shepherd. And we know He's not going to lead us wrong. Do we trust Him enough to follow wherever He leads? Even if He leads us through some paths that we don't want to go down. And a lot of times we are led down some of those paths. You know, all of us have faced the loss of loved ones. Maybe we've faced the loss of a job. Maybe we've faced the loss of our own health. We face all sorts of difficulties. God leads us through this life, heading us for where we need to go, which is heaven. But sometimes to get to heaven, we're going to have to go through some rough patches of terrain to get there. Do we trust Him enough to be good sheep and follow Him? Or are we going to be those naughty little sheep that wander off and wind up falling off into briars or brambles or falling off into a ravine somewhere? Wind up getting attacked by the wolves and the bears and the lions that are out there? How much will we trust Jesus? How well will we follow our shepherd? If you're here tonight and you've not been following the shepherd as you should, perhaps you need to respond to the invitation tonight and make the determination you're going to follow Him more closely. You know, the closer you are to the shepherd, the less likely it is that the lion's going to get you. The shepherd will protect you. But if you've wandered far away from the shepherd, if you've wandered out of His hand, you're in the lion's terrain. You're in the lion's domain. And He'll devour you at the first chance He gets. Get back in the Savior's hand. Get back in that shepherd's control and under His protection. If you're here tonight and need to respond for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.